In today's episode, I'm thrilled to have Professor Dr. Lee Hanscher, Professor of European Law at Tilburg University, together with her dog Kiki, as my guests. We are going to talk about energy law as an area of law, long-term contracts, contracts for difference, sustainability and competition in energy markets. Energy law can be defined very narrowly, only focusing on energy sector-specific regulations. It can also be defined rather broad, referring to all laws in their application on energy markets. It's a field of law that is constantly evolving. With that, let's seek into our exploration of energy law. Enjoy. I'm very excited today to talk to Professor Dr. Lee Hanscher from Tilburg University. She's a professor of European law here at Tilburg University, where we are today. She's also part-time professor at the Florence School of Regulation within the European University Institute, and also a senior advisor to Baker Botts in Brussels. Together with Lee, we also have Kiki in the room today, her small puck. Yeah. So if you hear some noises in the back, that might be her. Lee, great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
I'm very happy to have such an expert here today. And we would like to discuss a few things, starting also what is the role of academia and also of practice in energy law. But maybe first of all, you want to say a few more words about yourself.
Thank you very much. So again, very happy to be here to make this podcast. My name is Lee Hanscher. I've been working in the area of energy law for many years, almost four decades. I started studying energy law and writing about energy law at the European University Institute in Florence. And then I moved to the Netherlands, where I've worked teaching and researching energy law. And my arrival in the Netherlands coincided with the European Commission's initiative to open up energy markets. So I started working in the area at a very interesting time.
Yeah, that does sound indeed interesting. And you're also talking about energy law. So is energy law an area of law?
That's a very good question. I think there's quite a bit written on that very question and quite a lot of differences in opinion. I think there is a body of law that you can define as energy law. However, it crosses many different disciplines, so you can't put it in the box of private law or public law or contract law or commercial law. It's all of those. I think what's very important increasingly to look at energy law more as a collection of legal principles which unite those different legal disciplines, so that if you look, for example, at the principle of sustainability, which we'll come back to, I think, later on, or the principle of solidarity, those types of principles are, I think, specific to energy law and are becoming more and more defining in how we understand energy law and its role today.
If there is a specific area of law that we can consider or can call energy law, do we need specialized lawyers in those areas?
I think that's also a very good question. I often try to tell students that energy law, it's kind of a bit dry in the beginning. A lot of rules you have to look at, a lot of legislation. But you've got to learn to walk before you can run. And once you can run, it becomes very interesting. But you do need, I think, to persevere and build up a skill set to be an energy lawyer.
There we also come to the role of academia. So academia needs to train energy lawyers. How do you see this? Is this the main role of academia, of universities? What other roles are there?
Well, obviously students at a university will be studying many different subjects. Probably if you're looking at the bachelor level, you first need to get a good grounding in contract law, commercial law, European law. But at master's level, I think that energy law is a very interesting subject to challenge, to study, along with environmental law, climate law. I think for a master's level students, it's an important area that they should be encouraged to study.
And there are lots of publications also written on energy law at universities from researchers.
That's true. It is an area where there is a great deal to read online, as well as, of course, in the old-fashioned book form. And soon there'll be a library of podcasts and videos, of course. There's a huge amount of material. But I think what makes it particularly relevant and fascinating for students is that it's so topical. I mean, we have COP coming up. There's already, you turn on the radio in the morning and you hear already.
Can you explain a little bit what is COP for those who are not familiar
with it?
That
is, of course, the biannual gathering as part of the Paris Agreement to monitor how we're making progress towards the Paris objectives to keep emissions below 1.5%. So we have a COP, which will start in Abu Dhabi at the end of this week. And that then is already causing a lot of concern because it's supposed to be about phasing out fossil fuel. And however, what's happening, it seems, is that there will be a lot of side meetings about exploring for fossil fuel. So you can think to yourself, well, is that legal? What legal principles do we have to invoke to question that type of development?
So it's a highly topical area of law with probably lots of job opportunities now and also in the future.
Well, I think it's always important when you're talking about job opportunities that you have a skill set that's flexible. I think that if you learn the principles of energy law, the basic tenets, that's very important, that you can apply that skill. But you have to be able to develop your skill set. I think that that's very important. It's not a static area of the law. It's an area where there's a great deal of dynamics, and you have to learn how to approach that dynamism.
So it's a dynamic area of law, it's a highly topical area of law, and that is also where your practical experience feeds in.
Yes. I think that from an academic point of view, it's also quite fascinating that it's dynamic, that you have to also, of course, develop your own academic discipline continually. There are new issues coming up that from an academic point of view make it also very fascinating. But from a practitioner's perspective, yes, it's an area where you see many new developments coming through. So you're also constantly required to keep your skill set up to date, as it were.
Talking a little bit about your practical experience, anything specific that you would say this is something you want to highlight from your experiences? You also litigated a lot of cases. We talked also about long-term energy contracts. Maybe you want to elaborate a little bit maybe on this area. What are long-term energy contracts? Was there anything specifically important, interesting in your career on this?
Thank you. Good question. So, of course, all lawyers learn about contracts. That's fundamental to our legal studies. And then, of course, what makes energy law rather interesting is contracts are sort of at the basis of most transactions in the energy area. You buy and sell electricity, you buy and sell fossil fuel, you buy and sell wind energy. There's nothing that you don't, as it were, buy and sell. So contracts are fundamental. However, the energy market has traditionally been, if you like, tied up with a network of contracts. So you've had what we call incumbent suppliers. That's the large energy companies who have traditionally enjoyed monopolies, certainly in the past, before we created the internal energy market in Europe. So they had their own markets, and they tried to keep those markets for themselves by way of long-term contracts. So to make sure that the buyers, their buyers, didn't move to another supplier, they would try through contracts to keep them. So long-term contracts became problematic. In the transition we had in the 80s, early 90s, from national markets to a more integrated European energy market. And that meant that in order to make that transition work, so I'm talking about the transition to a supposedly single or one internal European market, it was necessary to get rid of long-term contracts. Now, that's not so easy because a legislator can mandate certain things, but you're interfering with legal rights. And that's where, obviously, contract law comes in, international law might come in, European law, many areas of the law will be brought to bear.
Competition law, especially.
And exactly, whether or not you can change a contract that's ongoing. Mm-hmm. Another area that proved to be very important is what we call European state aid law. If a government concludes a contract with a buyer or a supplier, the terms of that contract might be advantageous to the parties. And that could raise an issue of whether or not that advantage is in fact a form of state aid. And we saw that type of argument being made a lot during the transition from national markets to single markets, because governments created what we called at the time single buyers. They were often, in fact, transmission companies or special entities that were set up to buy the electricity from the producers at a fixed price over a long term. And the long term in those cases could be 20 years. And so the European Commission, which is body in Brussels, the executive of the European institutions, the executive arm, which is also the legal responsibility for enforcing competition law, state aid law, they started to challenge these contracts and to look at ways of reducing their length and their coverage. So 20 years, 25 years was much too long, and the coverage was too extensive because often the total output of the producers in the national market was contracted to this single buyer. So there was no way that anybody else could get into the market. So these long-term contracts reduced what we call the liquidity in the market, the amount of trade that could go on in a market. So if you were a new consumer, or if you were a consumer and you wanted to take advantage of your rights under energy law to choose your own supplier, in fact, you couldn't, because everything was tied up in these contracts. So what we saw in the 1990s, beginning of 2000s, was the European Commission and to some extent national competition authorities using, first of all, state aid law to try to eliminate these contracts. So that was a very important area of litigation that I was involved in, cases which involved then member states, particularly the new member states as they were then, Hungary and Poland, being required to adjust these long-term contracts to bring them into line with European state aid law.
How successful was the European Commission in their efforts?
They were quite successful in that they used these state aid rules for the first time to require contracts to be altered. If you read the relevant provisions in the treaty, this is Article 107 and 108 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, you will not see an explicit power given to the Commission to actually mandate that member states terminate contracts. So this was a rather novel way of using the state aid rules. The Commission adopted a decision. That's what the Commission has to do under state aid law, addressed to the member state, Hungary and Poland in this case, and required then those two member states to revise these contracts. And their terminology was quite careful, because they didn't say explicitly to the member states, you must terminate these contracts. They only said you must remove the advantage that state aid.
So contracts that were concluded between the member states and suppliers.
Yes, yes. So you had quite big suppliers that had gone into these markets to also modernize their means of production. So you had a lot of dirty old coal plants. So you had American companies going in, buying those plants, modernizing them. You had a French company, EDF, also going in, taking over plants, modernizing them. Electrabel, the Belgian producer. Many companies went into those member states attracted by these long-term contracts. They went into those markets. They tried to produce more environmentally friendly electricity. And those contracts gave them the revenue, a constant source of revenue that would finance then the investments that they needed to make that modernization. However,
so public goals, if I may say,
public goals
were achieved by giving investors investment security.
Yes, exactly. But the commission reasoned that they were the terms of these contracts were too generous, and that investors would still have gone into the market for a lower revenue, and that it was not necessary to have these contracts concluded for such a long term. So the Commission then required the member states to adjust the contracts. And that was an interesting experiment, if you like, in itself, because the question arose, as any contractual lawyer knows, if you terminate a contract, you could be exposed to a claim for damages. So compensation for breach of contract. And of course, the member states concerned did not want to have to pay compensation. Now, they wanted the commission to give them a guarantee that if these contracts were terminated contrary to international law, international investment law, that the commission would pay the compensation. Mm. And of course, the commission didn't want to pay the compensation either. So that was why wording of the commission's decision was very carefully framed so that it was clear that the decision to terminate the contracts would be a national decision. And if any claim for compensation arose, it would be at the door of the member states.
I mean, this is somehow today probably a different landscape. Also, mm-hmm. the European Court of Justice said that certain investment treaties, especially the Energy Charter Treaty, for example, should not be applicable between member states. Those new developments.
Yeah.
So maybe those questions, if they were asked nowadays, would be different than at that time.
Yeah. So these cases, actually, they triggered international arbitration. Under the Energy Charter Treaty, and they're different. You can have different types of international arbitration under that treaty. Some are closed and completely sort of private. Others are open. And the Commission began to adopt a practice of submitting letters to the arbitration tribunals. So open briefs to the arbitration tribunals telling these tribunals that they should not apply European law, and also telling them that if they did, the compensation that they were going to award, if they choose to award it, would also be state aid, and that would be illegal. At the time, most international arbitration tribunals ignored that, because they said we are applying international law, not European law. So there you see that energy law is actually very interesting, because it's made up of all these different types of law, and they don't necessarily all kind of coalesce or go in the same direction. There can be quite a lot of tension in the way they're applied. And this is a good example of where you do see indeed issues. But you're absolutely right. This is an area of the law that has since moved on. The European Court of Justice has ruled that international investment law tribunals should not be allowed to interpret European law, because that would threaten or prejudice the autonomy of European law. And why is that? Well, one of the reasons is because these tribunals make their own decisions, and they're not subject, usually, to appeal. So these cases would never get to the European Court of Justice. So the European Court of Justice could not supervise how European law is implemented.
Lose its monopoly.
It's a kind of a monopoly,
European law. Yeah.
And then, of course, in the meantime, the investment treaty, the Energy Charter Treaty, has come under a lot of scrutiny and a lot of, adverse commentary from academics. And as a result, a number of contracting parties have already withdrawn, and the European Union will itself withdraw.
Which then also creates new problems.
There is a clause in that treaty, that sort of sunset clause. So all the arbitrations that were lodged before must still be honoured, if you like. The contracting parties must honour their obligations up to, I think, 20 years after their withdrawal. So it will remain relevant for some time.
And there were, if I remember correctly, also discussions in the modernization process of the Energy Charter Treaty to modernize it, mm-hmm. and then also to give contracting parties a chance if they mm-hmm. kind of go further with the modernized Energy Charter Treaty to protect renewable energy better, or to foster the deployment of renewable energy better than under the current treaty, and that is still applicable for several years under that clause that you were mentioning.
Yes, the sunset clause. But you have seen now, because we've had a lot of disputes about changing the levels of tariffs and subsidies for renewable energy, which have also gone to these international tribunals. And the international tribunals have in many cases condemned the contracting parties for retrospectively changing these tariffs and required them to pay damages. So there is a provision in the Renewable Energy Directive that was adopted in 2018, which specifically requires member states not to change the terms of the subsidies or tariffs that they've agreed for renewable production. So they have to give notice, and they must, I think, they must not change anything for the initial 3 years having set those schemes up.
And coming back to those cases, you were also involved there as a practitioner. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I've been involved in cases on these long-term contracts before the Court of Justice. So what happened was that when Hungary terminated the contracts, that the Commission's decision was challenged before the General Court and then the Court of Justice. And the argument that was made was that this was no state aid.
And how exciting is this?
That's very exciting. Very exciting, of course. Yeah, I suppose all lawyers want to be litigators. Yeah. And then we also had arbitration. So I was also involved in the arbitration cases for a number of investors who challenged them the cancellation of these contracts and claimed damages.
So what is the future now for long-term contracts?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's an open question. So we're now in another transition. And I think it's very important for us as lawyers to realize that this is the first energy transition that is legally driven. So we have a legal target that's set up in the European climate law that by 2050 we're supposed to be carbon neutral. Now, we could have a whole podcast probably about the definition of carbon neutral, but the idea, of course, is that we should be not using any more fossil fuels by 2050. So not only is this a legal transition, a legally driven transition, but it's the fastest energy transition that we've ever experienced. It took us more than 100 years to go from coal to oil predominantly, and it took us more than 90 years, I believe, to replace coal, at least partially, with other fuels like gas. But now we have a window of less than 30 years to become carbon neutral. So this is a very daunting prospect. It has to be really fast, it has to be really extensive, and it will cost many billions. And of course, some countries are able to pay while others are not. So it's also supposed to be a just transition. The idea is that nobody is meant to be left behind. So it's fast, it has to be just, and it's all legally driven. So we will see, I think, a very important role for energy law and energy lawyers in achieving this transition, or maybe trying to slow it down in some ways. There'll be a lot of disputes, and I think that that's why energy law today is a really fascinating area of the law. So what does that mean for long-term contracts? Well, it means we have to maybe think about them in a different light, because maybe we need them again, because we want to give investors the legal certainty that they will get a return on their investments over the period of time that is needed to make those investments. Because most of the investments that we're looking at are capital intensive, especially, you know, offshore wind, for example, but even large solar developments. We need investments in the transmission facilities and pipelines and carbon capture facilities, you name it, hydrogen. This all requires a massive amount of investment. And to get the security of your returns, then long-term contracts come into play. And we see that if we look at the new regulation, still in draft, but it's almost finalized, on the electricity market design, it's called, that long-term contracts are really at the basis of that market design. So they're back in fashion again.
And they're back in fashion due to the same reasons that they were put in place years ago.
Partly, yeah, because partly they were put in place years ago to make sure we had the transition from the old dirty energy to clean energy. And again, they're put in place now, yeah, to facilitate that transition and to keep and to increase more stability in prices. I think, and what's happened in the meantime is, of course, we had the energy crisis in 2022 with huge price volatility. So, you know, prices going up and down massively. And that caused people to rethink our energy market models, especially the electricity market model, and to look again at the value of long-term contracts in keeping prices stable.
Maybe you can elaborate for our listeners. Why were they considered illegal state aid at an earlier stage, and why are they not illegal state aid nowadays?
Okay, very good question. So, first of all, they were considered illegal state aid at the time because they gave a selective advantage, that's the very definition of a state aid, to some and not to others. And that advantage was not considered to be justified, because the amount of investment that was needed did not, in fact, necessitate such a long-term degree of protection, nor did it necessitate the state taking on all of the risk of these investments. That was the way the Commission viewed it. Now we have a new system of long-term contracts, and they're called contracts for differences. And the idea behind those contracts is you get a contract with a state entity that will give you a guaranteed price. You will still have some risk as a producer, because you will have what we call the volume risk. So you will have no guarantee under this type of contract that you can sell all your electricity at that price. What a contract for difference does is it gives you the difference between the market price and an administrative price. But you still have the risk of the volume that you can sell. But that still is a state aid, because you're getting a benefit, an advantage. But what the Commission says is you must clear that state aid with us. So these contracts can be compatible state aid.
Plus, they are also provided by the European Commission in EU law.
Yes, they're encouraged, and that helps. But the terms of the individual terms, of course, still have to be supervised by the Commission. And we're talking here about a regulation, right? A regulation on market reform. But in the hierarchy of law, and here you have to also be a constitutional lawyer. When you're an energy lawyer, of course, you have the treaty, and then you have the regulation. And the regulation cannot, of course, detract from the power set out in the treaty.
In the primary law.
Yeah.
So maybe, yeah, a new rise of importance for long-term contracts, mm-hmm. for contracts for difference.
Yes.
Driven by the goal of sustainability, of higher share of renewable energy in the electricity systems and even beyond in other sectors in the European Union. How does sustainability change not only state aid law, those areas? Do you see a more general paradigm shift, maybe?
I think sustainability, the challenge of sustainability brings energy law into a new light, because what are we talking about? We're not just talking about more renewable production. We're talking about circularity. So you're looking at ways of producing that involve circular methods. You're looking at sustainability at overall resource use. So you look at the way land is used, you look at biodiversity, you look at the impact of energy production in a much wider frame than we would before. It's not just a simple energy and environment trade-off anymore. It's a much, much more complex system if we take the sustainability angle. So the dimensions of sustainability are much more complex. So that's one aspect. With sustainability comes you have the debate on resilience. You know, you want your energy supply to be resilient. So we're looking much more now at the whole value chain. It has to be sustainable. Circularity is very important, but it has to be resilient. So we're worried about imports from third countries where perhaps production isn't sustainable according to our European norms, or others' human rights issues. So these issues are all becoming very much part of energy law in a way that one wouldn't have thought would have been the case 5-10 years ago.
And how is competition law challenged by sustainability?
So competition law, there's been a big discussion, of course, in the area of competition law on to what extent agreements between producers or between competitors, what we call horizontal agreements, so producers or suppliers who are at the same stage of the production chain.
Maybe we can make an example to washing machine producers that want to collaborate, making higher price for their washing machines in order to have reduced electricity amount.
To reach a standard that would bring them up to the most efficient level of energy. That would be a horizontal agreement.
Because you would say that this is good, at least for the environment.
Yes. But of course, competition law is set out again in the treaty. So we have primary law here, and we have conditions in the treaty that require that benefits of such agreements are properly distributed, if you like, for the consumers. So the primary objective of competition law is to guarantee consumer welfare. We've just had a reform of the guidelines. So these are soft law guidelines. They can't change the treaty, but the Commission can implement competition law on the basis of these guidelines.
Kind of picking fights, you could say,
You could say that, but it also gives direction to national competition authorities as to how they should apply European competition law and national competition law. So this new set of guidelines does give some flexibility to allow companies to collaborate if they can show, they still have to show, that the environmental benefits will be passed on to the
consumer. So was competition law up to today too much focused just on prices?
Some people would argue that it has been too, because it's quite difficult to show that this benefit arising from these agreements is properly passed on to consumers.
Although you could also argue that a reduced amount of electricity that is needed to run your washing machine leads also to a lower electricity bill. So in that sense, this would also be linked.
That's true. There are various ways, there are good arguments to make, but you have to, I think, show that is exactly the case, that you can show that those benefits arise and that they will be passed on in full to consumers. That's the most important sort of obstacle for many of these agreements.
So in that sense, is competition law still more a barrier than a driver of sustainability in Europe?
Well, that's been something of an area of discussion, that the Commission should be more flexible. On the other hand, there are dangers. You see a lot of greenwashing. You can see companies agreeing to come up with standards that are not really very robust. So, you know, you can't just put a green label on something and assume that it's in the consumer interest. I think the competition authorities have to be alert that these types of agreements are not used really as a way of actually avoiding environmental obligations, because that is a risk.
So to summarize maybe this, we see that European law, EU law, is somehow changing, is adapting to the new challenges that arise from the goal of climate neutrality. Then maybe also due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there may also be some new challenges that challenge also the existing laws and regulations on the EU level. So there is a lot of stuff going on, let's put it this way.
Yeah.
And so also, especially the notion of sustainability does not change the treaties, but change their application.
Yes, because of course, many of the principles of sustainable use of goods and services, protection of the environment, they're general principles that we find in the treaty. So they're already in the treaty. It's just that they haven't been developed and applied very much yet. I mean, that is now coming.
And it also shows that national law only will not help in achieving climate neutrality, that EU law is a big player in this regard.
Yes, but of course, that's again, like many things in this area, is a subject of some discussion, because energy is what we call a subject where competence is shared. So the European institutions don't have the last word. Member states have a very important role in determining, as the treaty guarantees, their own energy mix. So it's a shared competence. So if it will be very interesting to see if a member state says we're not going to phase out fossil fuels by 2050, can they say, well, this is guaranteed by the treaty that we can continue to determine our own energy mix.
So I hope that for our listeners, Kiki didn't snore too loud. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much. Good chat. Thank you.
The first season of the Energy Law Podcast was made possible with funds of the Dutch Starter Grant Program, awarded by Tilburg University for my project, Transformation Processes in European and National Economic Law, Energy Law as Law of Socio-Technical Change. A special thanks for production support goes out to Mark Ohrendorf from Irgendwas mit Recht.